The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Pat Perry for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Money Matters. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer. Today's stories include: negotiations continue on months overdue state budget, and as Democrats bicker over spending plan, here's what is at stake for Medicaid. North Carolinians could be days or possibly weeks away from a state budget compromise between Democratic Governor Roy Cooper and the Republican Majority General Assembly. The three top North Carolina politicians who will make the final decisions on billions of dollars in state spending are expected to meet in person soon. Here's what you need to know as Cooper, Senate Leader Phil Berger, and House Speaker Tim Moore work it out. How does the budget process work? North Carolina's General Assembly is supposed to pass a two-year budget every other year during its long session. Each chamber takes turns offering their proposed budget first. In 2021, it was the Senate's turn. After that chamber passes its budget bill, the other chamber also passes a version of the budget bill. They often have similarities. Then a third version of the budget, called the conference budget, is passed by both the House and Senate, and that is sent to the governor to sign or veto. This year, the governor has been brought to the bargaining table before the final conference budget is released publicly, in hopes of avoiding a veto. Why it matters. When there isn't a new comprehensive budget by the start of the fiscal year on July 1st, no new money is spent. That means no raises for teachers, public school workers, and other state employees, as well as no new projects or programs. This has become evident this year with the shortage of school bus drivers and other education workers in the state and nationwide. A new budget could mean increased wages to better recruit new employees. Instead of passing a budget, state lawmakers sit on a $6.5 billion surplus, said Genesia Green, a Wake County Public School System bus driver, in September, the News and Observer previously reported. Green and the North Carolina Association of Educators were advocating for increased school personnel pay, which is part of the budget. Beyond raises, potential tax cuts, and programs, the state budget will also allocate millions of dollars in federal COVID-19 relief funds from the American Rescue Plan. That means worker bonuses and much more. This isn't the first time the budget has been really late. In 2019, there was no comprehensive budget at all. Instead, a series of piecemeal budget bills were passed over months. This year, Cooper, Berger, and Moore will negotiate the major issues before the conference budget is sent to Cooper. That's what they're doing this week after exchanging offers and counteroffers. How can you be heard? You can tell the state lawmakers who represent you what you think. While the leadership is just a few people, there are 170 state lawmakers in North Carolina, 50 senators, and 120 representatives. Their office phone numbers and email addresses are listed on the General Assembly website, ncleg.gov. Next, as Democrats bicker over spending plan, here's what is at stake for Medicaid. Hours after the Supreme Court in 2012 narrowly upheld the Affordable Care Act, but rejected making Medicaid expansion mandatory for states, Obama administration officials laughed when asked whether that would pose a problem. In a White House briefing, top advisors to President Barack Obama told reporters states would be foolish to turn away billions in federal funding to help residents lacking the security of health insurance. Flash forward nearly a decade, and it's clear to see the consequences of that ruling. Today, 12 Republican-controlled states have yet to adopt the Medicaid expansion, leaving 2.2 million low-income adult residents uninsured. Tired of waiting for Republican state lawmakers, congressional Democrats are moving to close the Medicaid coverage gap as they forge a package of new domestic spending that could run as high as $3.5 trillion over 10 years and would significantly enhance other federal health programs. But the cost is raising concerns within the party, and the competition to get initiatives in the package is fierce. With Democrats controlling both chambers of Congress and the White House, health experts say this could be the only time such a fix to the Medicaid gap will be possible for many years. This is a last best chance to do this, said Judith Solomon, a senior fellow with the left-leaning Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Here are six things to know about what's at stake for Medicaid. Who would be helped? The adults caught in the coverage gap have incomes that are too high for them to qualify under their state's tight eligibility rules that predated the 2010 health law but are below the federal poverty level of $12,880 a year for an individual. When setting up the ACA, Congress expected that people making less than the poverty guideline would be covered by Medicaid, so the law provides no subsidies for coverage on the ACA marketplaces. About 59% of adults in the coverage gap are people of color, according to a KFF analysis. Nearly two-thirds live in a household with at least one worker. The states that have not expanded Medicaid are Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Kansas, Mississippi, North and South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Wisconsin, and Wyoming. About three-quarters of those in the coverage gap live in four states: Texas, 35%, Florida, 19%, Georgia, 12%, and North Carolina, 10%. Why haven't states expanded? Republicans in these states have listed a litany of reasons. They assert that Medicaid, a state federal program launched in 1966 that today covers one in four Americans, is a broken system that doesn't improve health, despite dozens of studies to the contrary. Or they say working adults don't deserve government help with health insurance. They also complain it's too expensive for states to put up their 10% share. The federal government pays the rest. And they don't trust Congress will keep up its funding promises for expansion states. Each time Medicaid expansion has made it onto a ballot in a Republican-majority state, it has passed, most recently in 2020 in Oklahoma and Missouri. How would the Democrats' plan work? The House plan has two phases. Under the bill passed by the Energy and Commerce Committee starting in 2022, people in the coverage gap with incomes up to 138% of the federal poverty level, about $17,774 for an individual, would be eligible for subsidies to buy coverage on the marketplace. Enrollees wouldn't pay a monthly premium because the tax credits would be enough to cover the full cost, according to an analysis by Solomon. There would be no deductibles to meet and only minimal co-pays like most state Medicaid programs. Help not typically available under the ACA would be offered. For example, Solomon's analysis notes low-paid workers wouldn't be barred from enrolling in marketplace plans because they have an offer of employer coverage. In addition, people could enroll at any time during the year, not just during open enrollment season in late fall or early winter. Phase 2 would begin in 2025. That's when people in the coverage gap would transition to a federally operated Medicaid program run by managed care plans and third-party administrators. Enrollees would not pay any cost sharing in the federal Medicaid plan. Would the coverage be as good as if the states adopted expansion? It would be very close, Solomon said. The new plan would include coverage for all services defined by the law as essential health benefits, such as hospital services and prescription drugs. One difference is coverage for non-emergency transportation services would not start until 2024. In addition, during those early years of the plan, some long-term services for medically frail people typically covered under Medicaid would not be included, and some screening and treatment services for 19 and 20-year-olds would not be offered. The first phase would also not provide retroactive coverage for the 3 months prior to application. Medicaid today covers medical expenses incurred in the 3 months before an individual applies if the person is found to have been eligible during those months. One potential benefit of using the marketplace plans is they could have broader networks of doctors than those associated with Medicaid programs. How much would it cost? The Congressional Budget Office has not yet revealed estimates, although the price tag would likely be in the billions of dollars. The federal cost for covering people by helping them buy marketplace plans is higher than it would be if the states had expanded Medicaid. That's because marketplace plans generally pay higher fees to doctors and hospitals, making them more costly, Solomon explained. Could states that have already expanded Medicaid rescind that policy and require residents to get coverage under the new setup? The bill offers incentives for states to keep their current Medicaid options. If a state opts to stop spending funds on the Medicaid expansion, it may have to pay a penalty based on the number of enrollees that move to the federal program, potentially amounting to millions of dollars. Next, stocks give up early gain to end lower. Stocks closed broadly lower after a day of choppy trading on Wall Street Monday as investors prepare for a busy week of corporate earnings and inflation updates. The major indices made early gains but slowly fizzled as the day progressed. The S&P 500 fell 30.15 points or 0.7% to 4,361.19. The benchmark index gained as much as 0.6% in the early going. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 250.19 points, or 0.7%, to 34,496.06, and the NASDAQ shed 93.34 points, or 0.6%, to 14,486.20. Technology and communication stocks had some of the biggest losses. Facebook fell 1.4% and Intuit fell 1.1%. Most sectors ended in the red. Real estate stocks, which are seen as relatively less risky, were among the few bright spots within the S&P 500. Bond trading was closed for the Columbus Day holiday. The price of U.S. crude oil rose 1.5% to over $80 a barrel. Investors are looking ahead to the beginning of company earnings this week. Analysts have said that the latest round of corporate results could help give the market more direction after several choppy weeks. Stocks have been swaying between gains and losses as investors try to better gauge the direction of the economic recovery through the rest of the year. Banks will be among the first big companies to report their latest financial results and give investors more insight into how companies are faring amid concerns over the lingering virus pandemic and rising inflation. J.P. Morgan Chase delivers its results on Wednesday. Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and Citigroup will report results on Thursday. Delta Airlines will report its latest results on Wednesday. The airline industry is still struggling to recover from the pandemic shutdowns that began 18 months ago. Investors will be closely monitoring the industry's results to see how much of an impact the summer surge of COVID-19 cases had on the industry. Wall Street faced a quiet day of corporate news ahead of earnings. Southwest Airlines fell 4.2% after dealing with hundreds of flight cancellations over the weekend. Toy maker Hasbro fell 1.6% after announcing that CEO Brian D. Goldner is taking a medical leave of absence. Investors are also looking ahead to economic data this week that could shed more light on what's going on with inflation. The Labor Department will release its Consumer Price Index on Wednesday and its Producer Price Index on Thursday. The reports detail pressure from inflation on consumers and businesses. Companies from a wide range of industries have warned investors that supply chain problems and higher raw materials costs could crimp their financial results for the rest of the year. Wall Street is closely monitoring whether those higher costs and resulting higher prices for goods will hurt consumer spending, which is a key driver of economic growth. Inflation will likely remain the dominant theme swirling over markets through 2021 and into 2022, say Jay Hatfield, CEO of Infrastructure Capital Advisors. The upcoming Consumer Price Index data on Wednesday is likely going to be hotter than Wall Street expects, he added. Right when you're going into earnings, you have this CPI bomb that could go off, he said. We have a demand problem and a supply problem. There are too many dollars chasing too few goods. Next, RV parks full as some facing homelessness now move into vehicles. Nanette Wilson lived in her truck for over a year before she found a place to live. Her house in Boise, Idaho burned down and she had nowhere to go until she saved enough money to purchase a small RV. She moved into the Boise Riverside RV Park in Garden City in 2019 and got a job there working at the front desk. Since moving into the RV park, Wilson said she sometimes looks at apartment listings in the area, but everything is too expensive for her. She is a single woman living on her own and said she finally feels safe living at the RV park. Wilson's battle to find housing is a common one in the Treasure Valley as rents and housing prices skyrocket and more people are resorting to moving into their cars and RVs. Even so, RV parks are full and many in the valley don't offer long-term leases. The Idaho Housing and Finance Association's 2021 point-in-time count on January 27th found that 557 people were homeless in its Region 3, which includes Ada and Canyon counties, and 321 were living in vehicles. Jeanette Curtis, Outreach Program Director for Catch, a housing nonprofit in the Treasure Valley, said 223 people and families in Ada County living in their cars or RVs sought help from the organization last year. So far in 2021, she said 196 have sought help, including 97 families with children. It all boils down to lack of affordable housing, Curtis said. If they had an apartment they could afford, they would be in it. There just aren't any. Wilson said she has seen more people than ever living in their RVs and looking for places to park permanently. The Boise Riverside RV Park has 200 applications from people wanting to park there. The demand has doubled or tripled, Wilson said. We are full every night. Wilson said most of the park's month-to-month residents are people who can't afford a house or apartment. Most people have had to sell their houses and have bought an RV because they can't afford a new house or can't afford rent, she said. Christine Brown, once a Boise resident who now lives in Texas, said her son is now living in an RV but with no permanent location to park. Her son was evicted from his apartment in Boise while he was undergoing cancer treatment because he couldn't pay rent. Brown and her family helped buy him an RV just to get a roof over his head. It makes this mama's heart hurt, Brown said. The Riverside Park charges $500 for the RV site and $100 for the electricity. $600 a month is our rent, Wilson said. That is good compared to what we are seeing in the community. Natalie Sandoval, homeless education liaison for the Nampa School District, said the number of families living in RVs and other vehicles fluctuates. Some months a family will be on a friend's couch, while in other months they are back in their cars. In general, she is hearing about more families facing homelessness this year than in previous years. People who are experiencing homelessness are moving through a continuation of homelessness all of the time, Sandoval said. They may score a spot on someone's couch. Maybe they made some extra money and they can get a hotel room. People are bouncing around homelessness pretty consistently. The National Low Income Housing Coalition's GAP report found that Canyon County has a deficit of 4,380 affordable and available homes for the renters with the lowest incomes. The fair market rent for a modest two-bedroom home in Canyon County is $1,002, said Kendra Knighton, policy associate for the Idaho Center on Fiscal Policy, in an email. To afford that rent without experiencing housing cost burden, a renter would need to work full-time 40 hours at $19.27 per hour. The average renter wage in Canyon County is $12.52, meaning the average renter would have to work 62 hours each week to afford a modest two-bedroom home. A renter earning minimum wage would have to work 106 hours. Sandoval said many Nampa families who were facing homelessness bought RVs or campers with their stimulus checks last year. Anything that could give them a sense of maybe this would be better than bouncing around, Sandoval said. But this left families with a new problem, where to park their RVs. Sandoval said RV parks that allow long-term residents are full or require RVs to meet certain standards. Brown said that in her son's search for a place to park his RV, many places would not allow RVs more than 10 years old. Sandoval knows of one family parking their camper in Wilder, unconnected to any services. What we found is families were left with, where do I part the things, Sandoval said. As housing becomes ever less affordable, Curtis said there are no safe and affordable parking spots in Boise for people living in their RVs or cars now. She said Catch has been trying to work with the city of Boise to create some. In September, median rents in Boise were $1,102 for a one-bedroom apartment and $1,308 for a two-bedroom apartment, Liz said. An analysis by the city of Boise said the city needs more than 27,000 new housing units by 2030. Boise City Housing and Community Development Senior Manager Maureen Brewer told the City Council in August that 77% of those units need to be affordable to people making less than 80% of the area's median income, $67,000 for a three-person household. In California, the city of Sacramento partnered with a local nonprofit, First Step Communities, to open a city-sanctioned lot for homeless residents to park RVs and other vehicles and even to sleep in tents. The second lot opened in April. The two areas had 150 residents last spring. The two lots are staffed with case managers 24/7 to help people with housing solutions. CAP Radio reported this. Residents are not charged for parking or camping there. The city pays $157,000 per month to operate two parking lots and a campground, according to CAP Radio. Mike Dittenberg wants to help. He's the executive director of the Caldwell Housing Authority and is passionate about providing housing to everyone in the community. The Housing Authority runs Farmway Village, an affordable apartment complex in western Caldwell, made up of 225 apartments. Dittenberg said the Housing Authority provides workforce housing, farm labor housing, and housing for low-income people. Now he wants to open an affordable RV park where low-income residents and RVs could park long-term. People need decent, safe, and sanitary housing, Dittenberg said. The Housing Authority has open spaces, parks, and community amenities which would support the RV park. We have run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. I hope you've enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Pat Perry, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Money Matters is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.